Hey everyone, welcome to the 63rd episode of Baseline Intelligence, the podcast designed to make you a better tennis player and a smarter athlete. I'm your host, Jonathan Stokey. Today's guest is Emma Doyle. Emma is a speaker, coach, trainer, and is the author of the book, What Makes a Great Coach? On today's episode, we discuss how asking good questions can lead to great results, how you know if you have the right coach on your team, and her best advice for the 4-0 player. So sit back, relax, and prepare to become a smarter tennis player. All right, Emma, welcome to the pod.
Thank you so much, John, for having me as a fellow podcaster. I know how difficult it is to sometimes make everything work, the magic work, but I appreciate what you do. And yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, for the listener, if this is the version that comes out, it'll be an absolute miracle. We're using a speakerphone. We don't know what mics are recording. The technology is failing completely. So hopefully this airs, but it's super cool for me to have you on, and you are probably uniquely qualified to answer this difficult question that I have, which is, how do you find a quality coach, especially if you're not an expert in a field? You know, so I'm not an expert for my dog as a vet. So how do I find a good vet? And how does someone who's learning how to play tennis find the right tennis coach? So this won't be the most original question you've ever received because it's the title of your book. But in your opinion, what makes a great coach?
So first and foremost, a great coach has to understand the person in front of them. So if you are out there listening to this and you are maybe you have a coach and you're not quite sure if it's the right fit, no one knows yourself better than you know yourself. So start with a self-check, like a self-awareness snapshot of what your needs are, and begin with how you learn best. So start with, what is the best way that I take in information? What type of personality do I respond to best? Because a great coach has the ability to understand what's in front of them, to listen, to ask great questions with empathy, to understand your background, your culture, and then adapt their coaching style and their coaching approach to bring out the best in you. So in many ways, if you've got a coach who's very one-dimensional, this is the way they coach, take it or leave it, I don't believe that is the way of the future. I don't believe that's a coach that is moving with the times. I believe that is a very, say, more traditional approach. And based on my book, thank you for mentioning it, What Makes a Great Coach, is 520 of the world's leading coaches. So we synthesize that data into the top 10 practices. And those practices, and from some pretty amazing coaches, one of the ones that really stood out is listening. Think about it like even an interview. If you're going into to meet a new coach, one of the things you need to be doing is interviewing them in many ways and seeing what questions they ask of you. Are they asking how you learn best? Are they asking about you as a person and your background and your history? And of course, why do you play tennis? Like, tapping into the motivation, a great coach understands why you're there and how many times you're training a week and what you want to get out of it. So I guess if I had to summarize it, it would be this process of the interview around going beyond the surface level, not what's your best shot and what do you want to work on today? Or I call it the three-step lesson plan. If you're working with a coach that does, as they're walking out onto the court, they go, what am I going to work on today? As they're pushing the trolley out, then you really maybe need to do a reassessment.
So step one, then, before you even speak to a coach, is definitely that self-awareness. Because I have asked players a million times, like, are you playing for pure enjoyment? Are you playing for exercise? Are you playing to be number one in the world? And a lot of times there's a look that comes back like, never thought about it. You know, it's like, well, the plan is going to be incredibly different if your goal is to move around, have exercise, and make this the most fun hour you've ever had versus I just want to squeeze every ounce out. So what can someone do then? You're talking about self-awareness. Is it just asking themselves these questions in their own time and really spending time thinking about it and having that clarity before meeting a coach?
Yeah, but I think it needs to be your technical snapshot, your tactical snapshot, your physical snapshot. And of course, the side that I'm most passionate, most interested in is the mindset, is the emotional side. So all the emotional awareness work around how well you manage your emotions, what triggers you. It's crazy, even just on the weekend in a golf tournament, how many times people get so put off by those little things like, for example, the leaf blower, or, you know, the bird right when I was about to putt came through, or, you know, on tennis, there's a million things on tennis courts. Oh, the person next door grunts too loud and I can't focus. And it was actually your podcast, John. I was listening to an episode with Alistair around Michael Phelps's dad, who was talking about the what if game. And I've been playing the what if game with my players all the time. What if it lands on the line and, you know, they call it out? So you're actually in training, you're allowed to do that three times, so it doesn't bother you. Oh, you want to call a ball out that was on the line? Okay, I've got to bring my margins in, rather than, oh, that's an extreme example, of course. But the what if game, all the things that could go wrong. What if a string breaks? What if you forget your favorite piece? What if you forget your racket and you have to use somebody else's racket? I think it's a great activity for building adversity, building resilience. And of course, as we know, tennis is one of the greatest teachers of resiliency, and it is one of the practices in the book. So a great coach needs to be resilient. They need to be adaptable. They need to be able to bounce back themselves and help you build those skills. I'm so passionate, John. I'm just going to go there straight away in this episode and let everybody out there know how, like, the first practice in my book is decision-making, right? And I really do believe, and I love listening to coaches, and this isn't having a go at coaches, but I do believe we have a bit of a pandemic of over-coaching. We say things when we don't need to say things. We don't actually add any value. We say take the racket back but was that really what the player needed to hear? Maybe they were just running in late and they just needed a couple more minutes just to, you know, just to get into the rhythm or the flow or whatever it is. I just think we, as coaches, as an industry, we are not embracing the modern way that people learn, especially this next generation of learners coming through. And we're not embracing, I beg your pardon, let me reframe that because that's way too negative from Emma Doyle. I would more likely say I would love more coaches to embrace the power of empowering the athletes with decision-making. Decision-making has to be a part of who they are. They have to bring decision-making into the training, because the number one thing that I see out in tennis land still is people crack under pressure. Doesn't matter what, I don't care what level you're playing at. They crack under pressure because they're not training in realistic conditions. They're training to be ball hitters and not tennis players. They're training to learn sport, like, I believe coaching, too many coaches just teach tennis instead of teaching the whole aspect of great decision making and great choices and options and how to problem solve. Because if you can problem solve, let's be honest, when you're out on the match, your coach isn't going to be there to help you problem solve through that match. And I think it just builds so many other beautiful skills. So I know that was a lot of information to answer one question, but I'm passionate about it.
That was fantastic. And I just set a record. Usually I jot down like a follow-up question of something that intrigued me, and I have four. So now I have to choose which one I want to go with. I'll start with, you said we need to give the athlete power to make decisions. How do I, as a coach, give them that power? What can I do?
Okay. So I have a really simple philosophy around this. If you're dealing with a red baller, you might say to me, well, Emma, no, they can't make decisions. I've got to tell them exactly what to do. They can make decisions. I don't take my nephew to McDonald's and say, what do you want off the menu? I say, do you want chips or nuggets? Two decisions. So red ball, two options. Do you want to hit it left, right? Do you want to hit it short, deep? Do you want to hit it cross line? So that's red ball. Then orange ball, as the court extends and it becomes longer, not wider, then we want to help kids fall in love with the transition and the shape of the court. So decisions become around three decisions, three options for coaches. Do you want to rally, attack, defend? And then when we go into green ball and yellow ball, where decisions are all about all about myself. How do I like to play? And now I understand you, John, as my opponent, how you like to play. So now I've got the cognitive capacity to understand you. So therefore, decisions and questions need to be more open, and constraints that you put on the court need to be more open so I can problem solve. And together, it's more of a, the future of coaching is more collaborative. We need to be able to empower people with these decision-making skills by simply start with asking questions is step one, and use constraints-led approach to the training environment, which simply means using equipment, change the rules, change the environment, change the teaching style. That's all that means, constraints-led approach, to be able to bring out the best in somebody and help them unpack what's going to work best for them. So in a match, they back themselves and they know what to do in the moment rather than looking at the parent or the coach for the magic answer, like, what have I got to do here? Well, actually, what you need to do is tap into your resources that you know that you can do this because you've done it in practice. I work with, I'm not on court as much as I used to. Of course, I do a lot more corporate coaching these days, but I still work with one girl. I've been coaching her since I was 8. I can't help myself, Dahlia Scudoni, big shout out. She's just awesome to work with. And because we've been together so long, the minute I say pressure training, say we worked on something specific and I say pressure training, she does like a 180 and faces the back fence. She fires off her anchor, which she presses on the dampener, and she just says, I'm here, I'm ready. And then she spins back around, and then I put excess pressure on her. Things like, you know, we continue to do what we were working on. If she hits it in the net, -2. If she hits it long or wide, -1. When she gets to match point, I ask her how many goes at match point does she want. We've trained her now. She always says she wants one go at match point. And if she doesn't execute the activity or whatever we were working on, then she goes back to zero and she has to do it again. So it's like she just feels that pressure. And I do that with my little red balls. I'll have four cones, 3 yellow cones, 1 red cone, and they flip it over, the yellow cones, as they complete each of the tasks. And then when they get to the red cone, if they don't complete the task, they go all the way back. They flip over all the yellow ones again and start again. You can layer in pressure. You can do it in teams. You can dress it up in pairs. I used to do that a lot with my girl power camps. So we dress up competition so that it doesn't feel like I win or I lose. I experience winning and losing, or I like to say coming second if I'm a red ball or an orange ball. You didn't lose. You just came second in that activity in that time. So that's I've been coaching for over 30 years. I know I don't look that old. Thank God it's an audio podcast. But this is a philosophy of decision making. So red's all about me, egocentric. Orange is about the shape of the court. Green's about self and opponent. And yellow is the same. So that's a really easy philosophy that any coach can take on. And if you're an athlete listening out there and you get to the end of a 60-minute lesson and your coach hasn't asked you one question or one given you one choice or one option, then maybe you need to educate the coach or you need to get a new coach.
I'm glad you just finished that answer with that, because I was going to ask you said asking questions to the athlete. What makes a good question? Like, what type of question helps that athlete learn or apply? Like, what does that good question look like?
Oh, love that question. Oh my goodness. Thank you for asking it. The reason I love it so much is because I do have a TEDx talk. If anyone wants to donate 13 minutes of their life that they'll never get back. One of the keys to the talk is about future-based questions. So the power of, this is a great tip for coaches and for athletes out there listening to this podcast. If you simply say these two words, just these two words that I'm about to give you, it's a game changer. Those two words are next time. So next time, like let's say I'm going cross court and I've gone down the line and I was not balanced, I was out of position and I've missed it in the net. Hey, next time, what other options could I choose? Next time, what do I need to do differently? Next time, I need to be more balanced. Next time, I'm going to hit that high and heavy cross court. I'm going to be in a better position before I go down the line. Because if a coach asks you, hey, John, why'd you miss that ball? Well, let me tell you, John will give you an entire list of why he missed that ball. And subtle gender differences, if you're coaching women and girls in tennis, they will give you a lot longer list, generally speaking, right? Very critical, very self-critical. So, and analytical sometimes with that. So that's just, I'm not putting people in boxes. I'm just saying just some subtle gender differences there. So instead, avoid why questions and avoid past-based questions. So go with a who, when, what, how, what specifically is my favorite question. What specifically did you do well there? Sometimes we always ask questions based on what went wrong all the time. And just avoid that. It's just not going to empower the athlete. It's not the way the kids learn best these days because of the screen time. The screen time never says, if you're playing Super Mario Kart and you die, it doesn't say, you know, what'd you do wrong there or why'd you die? It just throws you back to the start and you go again, right? So instant replay, that's a great little constraints. You know, say nothing. Say, hey, freeze. Give them 3 seconds, but get the kid or the player to call instant replay on you rather than you being the, you know, the coach that's, you know, oh, let's do that again. Why don't you train the kid to say, I'll give you that again if you can tell me 2 things you need to do better? Or why don't you get them to press the instant replay button? So I'm very, very passionate about this topic, especially because I'm not in tennis as much anymore and I still want coaches to grow and learn, and because I believe they can, and I believe sometimes coaches don't know what they don't know. So it's not their fault. It's just they haven't necessarily been exposed, even though this style of teaching, game-centered, player-centered, constraints-led approach has been around for a long time. It's sometimes a lot harder. It's a lot messier. It's a lot slower at the beginning. But once a kid gets it, it's a lifelong game changer, and it's about learning through the sport of tennis, not learning just tennis.
You mentioned earlier the modern way that people learn, and you're mentioning screen time now. And I know for me, I turned 40 in a month. Like I'm panicking. I'm just going to be honest with you right now. I'm panicking. But the way I learn at 40 is significantly different than the way I learned at 25. And I don't know if that's screen time or just maturing, but you mentioned there's a new way that people are learning on the court. Can you just kind of elaborate on that modern way?
Well, I probably did use the word modern. I'll give you the 5 gaming principles that are really important that is more modern. But in terms of learning, I think the way people take in information and even the way that then they expire information, for example, can be different. But obviously we've got, you know, quite simply in schools, you'd say the VARC, the visual, auditory, kinesthetic, and the reading at school. And then more adult learning is VAKAD. So visual, seeing, obviously auditory, hearing, kinesthetic, feeling, and auditory digital is through a process of information. So that hasn't changed. That's not modern. That's just the way people learn. And of course, we have a preference. So as coaches, if you've got a group of people, we try and cover all those boxes. Absolutely. If it's a one-on-one, you can tailor a little bit more. And remember, coaches, we often coach the way that we learn best. So I'm very kinesthetic. So I'm very, right, you know, like all about feel. Okay, no. My biggest aha moment was like, oh, Emma, it's not about you. It's not the way you learn best. It's the way that I need to bring out the best in them. So if they need me to soften my tone, they need me to be a little less extrovert, they need me to perhaps talk in a way that they really understand the information. It's the same with a parent of a high-performance kid. Half of them are just auditory digital learners, and you just need to spend time with them and give them all the information. They're not HM parents, high-maintenance parents. They become Happy Mondays, because once you spend the time with them, they'll be your most loyal client. I went totally off tangent then, John. So going back to the modern 5 principles. So the first one is problem solving, or they call it puzzle solving. So creating problem solving environments. The next one is PVP, which stands for player versus player, which is our sport of tennis, which is competitive. The next one is social. So they play because their friends play and they want it to be a big group. And that's why I've had a lot of success over the years with my Girl Power camps, because so much of what we do is collaborative and teamwork and task-based activities. The next one is narrative. Kids learn best through a story and going on a journey. So, you know, even there's 4 parts to a point: the start, the setup, the opportunity, and the finish. I used to run a lot of my holiday camps that way, and that we'd have a theme each day: the start, the setup, the opportunity, and the finish. And then finally, the last one, which I think is the secret weapon of great coaches, and that is collectors. For example, just using like a footwork ladder in tennis and beanbags, there's 8 levels there. You can go up 8 levels within a lesson. And then even if you get to the 8th level and the lesson's still going, you can come back down the ladder. So they're collecting things. They're collecting, you know, red ballers, pegs or clothespins or whatever you call them. You can collect tickets. You can collect cards. You can collect, I have all these gemstone affirmation cards, put them under cones, they turn them over, and then they've got to say things like, I love the battle of competition. And, you know, we have to layer this stuff in. But they're the 5 reasons, the gamification reasons of why the online games are successful. And there's absolutely no reason why you can't layer that into your programming.
Back to my first follow-up question that I wrote down, which is something I am trying to do better. And obviously being a podcast host, I think I've gotten better over the last 2 years, but that's being a better listener. And so as a coach, but also just as a human being when I'm talking to other people. So what are the skills or talents of a good listener? How can anyone out there, not just a coach, become a better listener?
Be present. Be present. I think it's having the mobile phone in your pocket, it vibrates. You're thinking about already your next lesson, have they canceled? And you're not really listening to even, you know, stop asking questions like, how are you? Good, bad. Ask pattern break questions. I'm totally into pattern break questions on my podcast for season 6. My first question is literally summer or winter, savory or sweet. Yeah, your kid walks on the court. What's your favorite season? Yeah, it doesn't even need to be a closed question. Depends on how much time you have, but it could be an open question. Do you prefer to text or talk? Right? Like, so you're just finding out something, it's just a pattern break. Oh, no one's ever asked me that before. Or what are you reading or what are you watching on Netflix at the moment that you wouldn't tell anyone that you're watching it? Right? So there's so many little things that we can do. And the more distracted we are, the less we're able to absorb the information. And if you are somebody who forgets things, write it down, because there's nothing better than being able to just say or take a note in your phone after the lesson. Boom, I'm going to ask about how Sally's dog went, because she just said that my dog's having an operation. So I'm going to follow up next week and say, hey, how's your dog doing? I know that sounds really crazy, but it's so simple, and yet it shows that you care. And of course, what makes a great coach? Someone who cares. People don't really care what you know until they know that you care. So I really feel that, and let's be honest, my whole book and my whole podcast came about because I asked Roger Federer this question, and he said someone who listens. And then Judy Murray said someone who listens. And then Patrick Mouratoglou said you have to be able to hear what the player is thinking. And I was like, there's something to this listening. And my book is, they're not chapters, they're practices. You don't go listening, oh yeah, I do that, I'm really good at that, tick the box. Listening is a daily practice. Just ask my partner, I'm telling you. At the end of the day, I can be distracted. I'm still, especially if I'm still thinking about what I was working on and we're trying to have this conversation and I'm not present. And when you're not present, then you're not listening. So anything you can do to help yourself be more present, be more mindful, be more in the moment, be really there with the person, connect. And the other thing, what great coaches do, like, and I've seen some brilliant, more in the business world, to be honest, because sometimes I think as tennis coaches, we're so physical and we're on the court and we're moving and so forth. But I've seen some pretty amazing business coaches ask somebody a simple question and be able to then unpack that that's actually not what's going on for the person. Like, I mean, again, the simplistic example is, how are you doing? Fine. Well, they're not fine. They said that they're fine, but they're not fine. Their tone, their shoulders, their body language. Great coaches can tap into tone. They can tap into, do the words coming out actually match what's going on inside for the person? And then simply by saying, hey, you know, I noticed maybe is, you know, today, do we need to adapt our lesson today to bring out the best in you today? Because perhaps they just had a really rough day. You know, perhaps what you had planned is not actually what they need in that moment. So you have to be able to, I think great coaches, they listen with empathy to be able to then adapt and empower the person to bring out the best in what they need in that moment. And if you're not going to add value, don't say anything. And young coaches listening, sorry, one more thing. Sorry, John. one thing for great coaches, Judy Murray is, of course, she wrote the foreword on my book and she's one of my great friends. And her and I and my partner, we're going to Africa. We're running a tennis safari experience and we're doing a Women of Kenya entrepreneur evening and in August this year. Super excited to finally get to Africa and so forth. But she's been one of my mentors for many years, great coach. And she says, let the activity do the teaching for you. So with her boys from 12 and under, that is how she raised them. Just lots of little problem solving games. So they're both great tactically on court. You can see it in their decision-making skills, which she didn't say, you got to do this, you got to do that, because she was a beginning coach herself during that time. So if you can set up a great activity, if you can be mentored by someone where the activity does the teaching for you, and I simply mean by that, if instead of saying follow through higher, get the ball deeper, hit it higher over the net, just simply put some cones between the service line and the baseline and say, right, you get 3 points if you hit it between the cones and the baseline. Tell me they're not going to follow through higher. Tell me they're not going to be able to get that elbow up higher to get the ball deeper. The activity will do the teaching for them. So look for those solutions first. Get creative around those things. I always say, if you're still playing JAIL and OUT, please just jump on my website, acecoach.com.au. Yes, it was a shameless plug because I actually don't work in tennis anymore. So I house all of my tennis stuff on a website, right? Which is like a super cheap monthly fee. I don't even care if you join for 1 month and watch every single 800 videos. But there are games on there like Harry Potter, Bug's Life, Shrek, all the things that were popular even back then when I was learning, but it'll give you the tools to be able to create a game off the latest anime movie that's happening right now. Go into the cinema, watch the movie, get the story and create a tennis game and stop playing the old school games that have been around for years that actually have nothing to do with the tactical objective, because as we know, tactics drive technique. Okay, John, I'll stop. I'm passionate.
I love that. I want to see if you can take us all the way into the pod. This is great. I love listening. So one thing I want to get back to is you mentioned people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And hopefully you don't think I'm super heartless. That's definitely not the way that I learn. It's something I've worked on big time. And I have, with all the players that I've worked with more than a singular time or two, I have great relationships with. But also the way that I learn, like, for example, when I go to the doctor, I'm going there, I have an illness, I want that person to tell me what's wrong and help me feel better. And my doctor doesn't know me. And I personally don't care. I just go there and go, you are trained in medicine. Please fix my sore throat now. And if he does a good job with that, I'm going to keep going back. And if I go there and he misdiagnoses me, or I go there and 2 weeks later I feel worse and I go to another doctor and feel better, I'll go to the new doctor. It has nothing to do with the relationship. And yet with tennis, I've seen this firsthand with coaching, that you have to have a relationship, and yet the way you hit your forehand is so less significant than like your personal health or the health of your dog when you go to a vet. So why is it that a player needs to feel like you care for them to accept information on a tactic on the court or the way they're taking their forehand back, when in other areas of their life they might not need that similar relationship?
Well, first of all, John, I'm going to push you on what you first said. And I'm going to say, and this is a little bit around probably my background, my sister runs a holistic medical practice. And she's been doing, you know, trading those short medical appointment times her whole life. And she's older than me and she's now setting up her own. She's going out on her own now after all these years of trading. You know, you got a sore throat, here's a prescription, go get it, you'll feel better. And I'm more from the background of what's the underlying cause. So let's even think cause and effect. I'm working with a young mentee right now and he was talking about why the elbow is higher than the shoulder on this young kid's serve. He still gets into the trophy position, but he raises his and he pulls it down. He's saying, oh, I know the elbow's high. I'm trying to lower the elbow. But actually the cause was the speed of the backswing. It was too quick. And he's a, you know, the boy was a skinny framed boy. So no, he's using momentum to get the racket up high where he thinks it needs to be. So firstly, why do we get a sore throat in the first place? Right? Is it something that we need to have a conversation with somebody that we're avoiding? Are we burnt out? Are we overworking? Is the cause, is the solution just to get a prescription? And this, now take this into the tennis world. A lot of people come and say, well, I just need you to fix my forehand. I don't care whether you like me or not. I don't care if we get along. I heard you've got the greatest technique on how to fix the, remember the multi-segment forehand. No, you're too young. You're only turning 40. So, but okay, you know the multi-segment forehand. But basically, you know, this is like literally my dad took me to this coach because the kick serve was like the latest and greatest. And this one coach had a really great kick serve himself. The ironical part was he didn't know how to teach it. He was really good at it himself. So I'm getting to the point of your question, but I just wanted to push back on that to say that too many times people are looking for a Band-Aid solution. People are looking for, I just want to learn this modern forehand, then my forehand's going to be great. Well, if you don't understand how your forehand fits into the bigger picture, if you don't understand the tactical implication of the want and the need to get a bigger forehand, then you'll either it'll work momentarily, but I'm always talking about long-term sustainability. I want people to fall in love with the game of tennis. I want people to play for the rest of their life. I want people to have more of a holistic view of why they play tennis and understanding that, because motivation, and a young mentee of mine taught me this just last week, shout out to Yosua. He said, motivation equals process plus purpose. Having a process that you can do over and over again and having a purpose will give you the motivation to then want to improve your forehand over the long term versus a coach who comes in and you just fix my forehand because you're really good at fixing forehands. So does a coach need to care? No, they don't need to care. Am I saying what great coaches do? They care. And does a player need their coach to care about them? No, they might not need that. They might say, well, Emma, that's fluffy and that's not important to me. Okay, but over the long term, I wonder if you'll go that extra mile if you know that that coach is in your corner. So the source is what I encourage people to get to. Root cause, whether you're a coach listening to this, don't just fix what you see. Go beneath and check whether that's actually what you need to be focusing on, what you need to be addressing.
Okay, I've got you for two more minutes. I'm going to leave you with the last Instagram question, which I usually do, which, what is your best advice for the recreational adult or the 4-0 adult tennis player? You get one piece of advice you can give them. And you have about 120 seconds to give it.
Have a coach that can train you how to think for yourself. So once you think tactically on what you need to do on the next point, work on how to be in the moment. Just trust yourself, trust your body. You've already thought, you don't need to do any thinking. Turn the brain off and let it happen. So whether that's I do a lot of anchoring, thumb, index finger, middle finger. It could be the dantner, it could be the butt cap, but be in the moment. Something like, I am ready, I belong here, I'm present, I can do it, but not I'm going to win this point, or my forehand's so big, or just something that keeps you grounded. I'm grounded, I'm ready, I'm here, I am now. Something that just allows you just to trust the body. And you can only do that if you practice with pressure, not under pressure. Practice with pressure, with a coach who empowers you to make decisions, so that the coaching is a collaborative process.
I know you got to run, so I'm going to tell everyone where they can find you. You got a million things going on, but thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
You same. Take care.
All right. I want to thank Emma for coming on the show. Again, it is a minor miracle that all of that recorded and got out to you all. She gave so many incredible insights. I think the main takeaway you can leave her episode with is becoming very self-aware, particularly to how you learn. Some people like to see it. Some people like to listen to it. Some like to take action and feel it. But when you start working with a new coach and you want quick, efficient results, it's probably a good idea to know upfront how that coach needs to deliver that information to you.
If you'd like to support the show, I have bonus episodes available on the Apple Podcast app, where I have extra interview questions from guests, as well as short episodes where I share my own coaching advice on a variety of topics. Thanks again for listening. I hope you just improved at tennis without even hitting a ball.